Welcome to Animal Voices. And in this program, Animal Voices, we seek to present and produce a radio programs that deliver a message that inspires people to improve the lives of animals. Every creature deserves to live a life in that promised Garden of Eden, the chickens, the turkeys, the pigs, and the cows. All of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty, free from the harsh conditions that factory farming imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. The existence of organized cruelty, that is, cruelty practiced as a matter of social principle or public policy and presented to the community as a means of a higher goal, is the most obscene and decadent phenomena in any civilization. And that was Claire Booth Luce who said that. Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, affectionately known as Co-op Radio, your commercial-free and community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Alan Jensen is the technician and co-host. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today, we do not have our co-host Marge Adams. She's out of town today. Hope she's having a good time on her cruise. Shortly, we'll be speaking with Terry Slack, who is a fisherman, naturalist, and historian. And we'll be talking about the Fraser River and the Georgia Strait water and sewerage issues. In the second half of the program, we will hear People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, president. She's the president, Ingrid Newkirk. She has a presentation called Nonviolence Includes the Animals. It's a wonderful presentation, so you might like to stay for it. One item that's a protest that's happening tonight, May the 2nd, Friday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Café de Paris, 751 Denman Street, and liberationbc.com. They'll be showing undercover footage of foie gras farms and collecting signatures from pedestrians to ban this cruel product in Vancouver. Foie gras is the diseased fatty liver of ducks and geese who have been force-fed to the point of death. In order to make the liver fatty, a long metal tube is shoved down the bird's throats and large quantities of food is pumped into the stomachs. For the last 2 weeks of their lives, the birds are locked up and force-fed up to one-third of their own body weight each day. So if you go to this protest meeting tonight at 7 p.m. at the Café de Paris, 751 Denman Street, the ducks will thank you. So, Alan, you're a great ornithologist, a great lover of birds. And there have been a number of issues here about migration. And one of the items that caught my eye was this migration. Maybe you can just give us a little info on how birds migrate.
It's actually a fascinating story. And in recent years, there's been a lot of research done. Well, people have been thinking about it and talking about it for hundreds of years. Probably, I'm sure, you know, Aristotle and the ancient Greeks were wondering how it was happening. And people realized a long time ago, because birds tend not to migrate on cloudy nights. The most birds migrate at night because it's safer at night. There's no raptors, no people like hawks and things to hunt them down at night. It's safer. But they usually don't migrate much if it's cloudy. And so it was determined or figured out a long time ago that navigating by the stars is one way that birds do navigate. And it's amazing because some of them travel thousands and thousands of miles from the Canadian Arctic down to South America and back. And the question is how they do it. And also, on clear days, they can see landmarks. And they see the same way we can from an airplane, see peninsula or something on the, or a lake down below. The bird can see that, too, and remember it. So they have a built-in navigation system that they learn and remember, navigating by the stars and navigating by landmarks, which is totally incredible when you think about it. These small creatures store all this information, and they learn this information. A young bird doesn't know very much. It kind of knows it's supposed to go south, but after 2 or 3 years, it learns this information, detailed information about where good places to stop and get food on the way, flying all the way from the Arctic to South America. They have to stop and eat here and there. And we're lucky that in Vancouver we have some of the most important areas down around Boundary Bay for migratory birds to stop and eat on the way south and north. But also, there was questions that could never be answered, and it was theorized quite a few years ago that maybe birds are able to detect magnetic fields and the magnetic field of the Earth. And recent studies have been showing that, in fact, birds can be sensitive and sense magnetism and magnetic fields, and they can sense north and south. Because the question was, how does a young bird that hasn't learned yet, how do they manage to travel? Magnetism made sense, and now recent studies have been showing that it actually works.
So one also wonders, with so many cities, with these birds traveling thousands of miles, that the lights would interfere with maybe the cycles of the moon and, if that's a navigational aid. What do you think about that?
You'd say lights?
Yeah, the city lights.
City lights are a big problem, yeah, because birds do see them, and it definitely, they're influenced by the lights they see, and it definitely causes them to go off track often, causes them, in fact, to head towards the lights, because sometimes they're heading towards lights like stars or the moon or whatever, but if they see bright lights in the city, they're liable to start heading towards them, and they're liable to start running into buildings. And there's no question that leaving high-rise buildings lit up at night is a big problem. And, in a big city like Toronto or Vancouver or other big cities where they leave office building lights on all night, that definitely attracts lots and lots of birds right into those buildings. And, in the morning they're littered around. We don't see them because somebody goes out early in the morning and picks them up, right? But that happens.
Yeah, it happens at UBC. Now, I believe we have our next guest on the line, but we do, there was this issue of Syncrude, the gigantic oil extraction industry in northern Alberta, and it hit the headlines on the international press. And what caught my eye was that there were some 500 ducks that flew into this settling pond.
That's what they're admitting to, 500. I wonder about that number. I bet it's a lot more than that. And I bet they're just talking about one Syncrude pond. I bet there's more than one pond, and I bet that there's a lot more than 500 ducks. And many other birds, not just ducks, who migrate north this time of the year. There's many shorebirds like sandpipers. There's loons. There's grebes. There's huge numbers of ducks, like hundreds of millions, believe it, of birds fly to northern Canada in the summer. Like hundreds of millions, like vast numbers of them. We're one of the most important areas for birds in the world, and they're flying north at this time, and they get tired, and they have to stop by some water to get a drink or to rest, and the moment they hit that water, it's game over.
So it was oil in the water, and there was snow on top of it. And what caught my eye about this article in National Post was that it said that bad publicity of how unenvironmental these settling ponds are coincided with the provincial government of Alberta, which was spending $25 million in the recent provincial budget for promoting Alberta as and the oil sands as environmentally friendly.
Yeah, that's a sick joke. But anyway, we can talk more about that later because Terry Slack is on the line.
Well, welcome to Animal Voices. Terry Slack is a retired fisherman, and he's a naturalist and historian. Welcome to Animal Voices, Terry Slack.
Oh, thank you very much, Carl. It's good to be here. Yeah.
Well, I really love the history that you've put together and studied for so many generations, and you've observed the Fraser River fish stock declines. Maybe you can just give us a little historical perspective here from what you've seen.
Yes, well, my family came out to the Fraser River from England in the 1930s, and I came out in 1948, and we've seen a river die. We saw the north arm and the middle arm of the Fraser River polluted to death in the 1950s. It was where you couldn't even put a net in the water, and it filled with all kinds of floatables from the sewage, which was entering the north arm of the Fraser River from Vancouver, Burnaby, Richmond. It all pumped their sewage directly into the river, and the salmon in the 1950s no longer wanted to migrate up the river. They hit this wedge of pollutants and turned around and went back, and when it went to Steveston to make their migration up the river.
So what were the pollutants, Terry?
Well, the pollutants were coming from mostly, you know, they were pollutants which cause oxygen depletion in the river. The river was bubbling from bank to bank because it was full of contaminants which were causing oxygen depletion in the river, and the fish could not need the oxygen to survive, and raw sewage entering the Fraser from hundreds of different places in the lower river here. They just couldn't find enough oxygen to be strong when they reached the spawning ground.
Now, Terry, you mentioned the 1950s. When did you start seeing that there was such an abundance of salmon going up the Fraser River? It was was considered to be a resource which would never cease to be. And in which years did you see the declines? Because you were a fisherman, you saw it firsthand.
Yes, well, in 19, I studied salmon. I fished salmon for over 60 years now, and since I was a boy on the river, and I got interested in when I saw the start of the declines in the 1950s. And when I look back at the history, I it's very, very plain that the North Arm had some of the largest runs of sockeye salmon in 1901 ever seen on the coast of British Columbia. And in the 1950s, nothing would enter that river, and our family had to move our nets and our boats and move to New Westminster, and it started to recover a little bit when we actually saw the first sewage treatment plant, which was Iona Primary Treatment Plant, opened. It opened in 62 when they first let the effluent onto Sturgeon Bank.
Now, you spoke about the... we're just going to say a little bit about why we're doing this program, because there have been hearings in Vancouver about whether, about the upgrading of the sewage system. So maybe just before we talk about the opening up of Iona Island by Dr. Shrum, which is a great story, why were these hearings being held? And the people can still write in, of course, to give their submissions, but especially after they hear what you're going to be saying about what the situation is right now.
Well, the situation right now is the plant is overloaded. It's been overloaded for 10 years. The Musqueam people do not fish in the North Arm. There's no salmon migrate up. Again, we're getting back to the 1950s. We are in a new century here, and we're slipping backwards instead of going forward and treating our effluent and putting it in a clean way into the Gulf of Georgia. And clean overflows must go into the North Arm, and we can understand that, but we cannot understand why the GVRD or Metro, the Metro waste people, wastewater people are saying, well, no, we shouldn't do anything for another 20 years, and well, that's the end of our salmon if that happens. Anisis is putting all kinds of chemicals into the Fraser River, right in the noses of these fish that are heading home to spawn. They're being flushed through with all kinds of chemicals from Anisis Island, which is secondary treatment. And I did a lot of studies from the United States. I looked at them, I examined them, and we have to start finding ways to make our water clean. Mr. Shrum was told us in the 1950s he was going to go to Iona, and the first effluent, what came out of the plant, he would take his coffee cup, dip it into the effluent, and drink it. Mr. Shrum, and I was there, never even, he didn't appear that day when they opened the plant. And he would have probably grown horns out of his head or something from the stuff he was ingesting. But again, it's a long story, and we're now getting to the point where the GVRD thinks that they're going to, hoodwink us by saying, oh, yeah, we're going to do something, but it's not going to be for another 20 years. And if that happens, if we don't change their mind and make sure that they do this as soon as possible, there will be nothing left. There will be nothing left on Sturgeon Bank, on the North Sturgeon Bank, where I commercially fished for over 50 years. The whole bank now is a mess. The inshore is a mess. And a mess means that it's polluted, and the sediments are polluted, and the crabs are polluted, and the shrimp and stuff, what people are out there catching and selling, they're never examined, they're never checked for contaminants. So, you know, GVRD Metro has got to get their act together here and get this thing cleaned up as soon as possible.
So Iona Island is a primary treatment. Maybe you can just tell people what primary treatment is. And then what happens when there's does all the rainwater from the roads, from the gardens and everything overflow? What happens when it rains heavily and it all goes down to Iona? Maybe just explain that.
Yeah, well, primary treatment means that in the summertime, they will scoop off the floatables, and especially when it's raining, when we had a rainstorm go through Vancouver, it loads the plant in a matter of hours. And the first flush in the morning, of course, everybody first flushes in the morning, and it loads the plant again. The plant is antiquated. It should have been built to secondary treatment many, many years ago in the 1960s. It should have been secondary treatment, and it should be upgrading now to tertiary treatment, which would handle a lot of these mind-boggling chemicals which we're flushing down the toilet and stuff, and they're getting into our waterways. And so, you know, the whole issue here really is that, do we want a clean Gulf of Georgia? Do we want a clean Fraser River? Do we want salmon? If people say no, we don't want that, then let's just throw the towel in the ring right now.
So in winter, when it rains heavily, is there a possibility that in Iona Island, raw sewage goes into the Georgia Strait?
Well, in the wintertime, when you have these massive rainstorms, and we're getting more and more of the global climate change, it just flushes. They actually stop it before it gets to the plant, and there's three main outfalls: Point Grey, there's another one up in McCleary Golf Course, there's the Angus outfall, a deadly outfall right in the middle of the North Arm. They all start letting go a whole bunch of untreated, sewage directly into the river. And that's what's happening in the wintertime. In the summertime, the plant does something very strange, because they're worried about our beaches, about all the beaches around Vancouver on the flood tide. It takes a lot of their effluent from the plant, and it pushes it in with the tide and goes into our beaches of English Bay, and they're starting to get a little bit worried about, and so they should. So in the summertime, they chlorinate the heck out of the effluent they're pumping out. But it's such a huge volume. I'm just looking out my window now on that Marine Drive and noticing that there's just tons of more traffic. People, they're going to put 15,000 people in the next 10 or 15 years out on campus, and they're all connected to Iona. They're all going to flush in the morning over to Iona, and we're not going to fix a plant. Over in Falls Creek, we're putting another massive amount of new people. They're all flushing their toilet in the morning, and they're all putting chemicals into it. Pharmaceuticals, everything gets over to Iona. And when it gets to Iona, it's primary treatment. It's lucky to get scooped off just the floatables, and then the rest of the stuff is flushed out to the Gulf of Georgia. The Gulf of Georgia, I fish there. It's in terrible condition. Well, don't let anybody kid you. Don't let anybody kid you that the Gulf of Georgia is in clean, fine shape. And a lot of scientists say it is. And you go out there in the summertime after a heat wave and have a look what's out there in front of that plant. It's absolutely disgusting.
So what is this plankton bloom where the pipe goes out from Iona Island? There's the birds are feeding off this. There's crabs. They're eating it. Nobody's supposed to eat this excrement from humans, but they could be recycling their own food.
I think what's happening here is that, the plant has a record of making mistakes. This primary treatment is the beginning of trying to treat our sewage. Secondary treatment is making sure that a lot of these, the heavy metals and other things are taken out of the effluent. And tertiary, Mr. Shrum could dip his cup really into tertiary and come out fairly well. But when I think about, what are we going to do? We're not going to do nothing. Absolutely nothing until we have a crisis. When the crisis comes, it's going to be crunch time. We're going to have to be doing stuff in a hell of a hurry, trying to build a secondary treatment plant fast, because we've got a disaster right in our door in the foot of Vancouver. It's going to happen. I can see it happening. Now, you know, my research and my work on the river, it's going to happen. There's no way we can avoid it now, because the only act, our masters only act when there's a crisis. And it's coming quickly.
Now, you've been talking about heavy metals, and we also know that these heavy metals and estrogens, and they affect the new generation, the fish. And I believe among the fishermen, and of course you were a fisherman, there's a thing called ogopogos, and about the sturgeon. What have you seen there?
I do a lot of work on sturgeon restoration and conservation on the Fraser River, and I know, and I got a mysterious bundle of photos that were pushed in my mailbox about 3 years ago, and I opened them, and I was absolutely mind-boggled. I couldn't think of what the... I had to think, what the heck is happening here? I mean, these pictures were identified as being taken off the outfall of the Anasus Island sewage treatment plant, which is a river what runs into the Fraser. It's the effluent coming out of that plant is so huge that when you go and have a tour, and your listeners should go and phone them up and say you want to take a tour and ask them some really serious questions, because people don't. They just go through there and think, oh, this is nice. There's a river of contaminants entering the freezer. I mean, they can't get it out with secondary treatment. They can't get it out on the Columbia. They can't get it out on the Sacramento. You know, the issue is, even tertiary, now we're having a problem because the chemicals you just mentioned, the pharmaceuticals and stuff, they can't get them out. And we see all kinds of strange things. And what we saw, what these pictures, what were delivered to my house were a whole bunch of sturgeon what had deformities out of this world. They had their mouth on top of their bodies. They had ogopogo-type backs. They had humps and lumps all over them. Hello, I mean, this is the canary in the coal mine. It's saying to us, something's wrong here.
So did you hear about the study in Norway that they found caffeine in the Arctic and in the fish?
Yes, I've been doing some research on caffeine down on the Columbia and Sacramento, and when they test in the river there, we don't do it here. I've always asked DFO why you don't do it. I mean, caffeine, we don't know what it does to fish, but it's a chemical. It's everywhere. In the Gulf of Georgia, I should imagine it'll probably go off the scale when they do the testing, because it's in this flushing motion of the tidal movements in the Gulf of Georgia. It must be loaded with caffeine. We can't keep drinking this stuff. It goes right through our bodies. It goes right to the Iona sewage treatment plant. It goes right to Anasus. And what happens there? They can't get it out. It's a chemical they cannot remove. And it goes out of our rivers. The fish water coming in ingest it. The bottom of fish, it falls down into sediments. The sediment, you know, fish water on the lower levels of the river take it in, and there's a worse chemical which I think is all around us. We don't even know about. It's called antisapstans, which the mills of the Fraser have used for probably 30, 40, 50 years. Old PCP types of chemicals, which used to take the fungus and stuff off of lumber. It's all flushed into the Fraser. It sits in the sediment. And our fish ingest it. And we're just saying, you know, hello, let's do the studies. Let's do the science. Let's find out what's wrong. Let's not dirty our house anymore. Let's try to fix it.
It was interesting to hear you mention the sturgeon, because I wanted to ask you about the sturgeon, because, of course, they live in the river. We started off talking about salmon, which migrate through the river. They spawn up through there. And I was wondering how much the salmon are affected by the sewage. Obviously, like the animals that live there, the crabs and other fish, the bottom fish and so on, who live in the region, must be incredibly affected by this stuff that Iona and the other plants are spewing out. But how much are the salmon affected?
Well, the salmon are moving quite quickly. They don't stage anymore. We're seeing a massive change in our salmon's migration timing now on the Fraser. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans cannot figure out what's gone wrong, but you can't keep putting these chemicals in the water and say, well, you know, they're not affecting them, because they're not testing. They're not testing these fish to find out if there is some problems there with what we're doing to the river with our discharges from sewage treatment. Don't forget, there's sewage treatment all the way up to Prince George. In fact, past Prince George. We're treating most of these plants upriver are secondary treatment, but there's one or two water tursh still what we call primary treated, and the mills, of course, all the mills, they've done a fairly good job of cleaning up some of their some of their PCPs out of the actually PCBs out of the system, and that's, you know, there is some room here to get industry to do best management practices. You know, we're at the bottom of the river; they're at the top, and we get what they put into the river, and let's have them all the industry on the Fraser should be using best management practices and doing what they can for the Fraser. But I'm not seeing that.
Now,
I'm seeing a lot more of when you ask a fisherman on the Fraser, what are you afraid of? He's afraid of the water looks clean, but it's not.
Now, in closing, Terry, there have been these Metro Vancouver hearings in many of the districts. And what do you think they should be doing just to make the proposal that to speed up this? What is it that why you went to the meeting at the Vancouver Public Library and spoke out so clearly? I loved every word you said.
Well, I'm looking at it now. I'm just looking at this multiple discipline approach to the removal of emerging contaminants in municipal wastewater treatment plants. It's right here. It's in front of me. It's about 10 pages long. It's a technical conference findings from November 2005, and it says one thing. You can read it all, and it warns us about we have to get a handle on these contaminants what run through our sewage treatment plants. And this is probably the most important sentence, and it says over half of the frequently detected environmental contaminants were reduced by 95% or more in samples. That's a wonderful reduction collected at plants which were operating in an activated sludge process. So if you've got new plants coming on and you're going to upgrade Iona to secondary treatment, they have to. My God, they have to go to the activated sludge process. If they don't, then we are in serious trouble. We're in serious trouble now. But if they ignore this report, then we're in very, very bad place. And it says here, if the plants what use, for instance, trickle filtering treatment process, that's Anisys, and that's what they're probably going to plan for Iona, that they'll only be able to remove 10% of the environmental contaminants. That's the key. You either build the plants with activated sludge, with the activated sludge process, or else you are wasting taxpayers' money. You're killing the environment.
Thanks, Terry. And if people we can go to georgiastrait.com, Strait spelled S-T-R-A-I-T, georgiastrait.org, georgiastrait.org, and they can see what whom they should be writing to and get an update, georgiastrait.org. It's a wonderful organization. Terry, you're a great inspiration for a cleaner environment and for saving the salmon, which is our national heritage.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Thank you, Terry. Okay, and yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. You're listening to animalvoices.org. And we have a very special treat today because we're going to be listening to a recording of a presentation made by Ingrid Newkirk. She is the founder and she's the president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, the much loved and also reviled organization because of their activism, but she speaks out loud and clear and in a very beautiful way. And so her presentation is called Nonviolence Includes the Animals. Nonviolence Includes the Animals.
And it's introduced by Dennis Kucinich.
He ran for president.
I was just going to say, one of the big disasters of this year's presidential campaign in the States is not enough people rallied around the fact that Dennis Kucinich had put himself forward as, I forget which party, but whichever party, I'm assuming it was the Democrats, but alas, he sort of fell by the wayside, but it would have been such an amazing thing for the planet if somebody like Dennis Kucinich had become president of the United States. Can you imagine, right?
Kucinich, and he's a vegan.
He's a vegan, and he's a clear thinker. A would have been a good person, but nonetheless, we will hear him introduce the speaker, the guest speaker, Ingrid Newkirk. And we'll see how much of this we can fit in the time remaining on today's show. So let's head off to, was it San Francisco? Wherever this was recorded. And we'll find out.
Most of us would agree that the three most precious words in any language are peace on earth. It is what we all say we want. And it is what anyone caught up in war longs for. Yet on any given day, there are dozens of wars being fought in the world. Each one causes great physical pain and suffering, displacement, fear, death, and grief. Some wars are fought for land or other resources, some for religious or cultural domination, or out of fear of being attacked first. But all wars require that we cope with the destruction of life by abandoning our good nature. We do this by lumping every individual together, including children, the elderly, kind and peaceful citizens, into one indistinguishable mass, which we label our enemy. It sometimes takes courage to go against the grain and to say and do what our heart tells us is right. In December 2005, Ingrid Newkirk, the president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, traveled to Palestine to address the conference on nonviolent resistance. Her message was that the principles of nonviolence require us to reexamine our relationship with the animal nations. I hope her talk inspires in you a desire to help increase the sum total of peace on earth every single day of your life. Thank you.
It is my great pleasure to address so many kind people gathered at this conference to share strategies and seek solutions. Everyone listening is a person of principle, and today I must ask you to open your hearts and minds to the possibility that how we treat animals is an issue which goes to the very heart of who we are. It helps us determine if we have grasped the most basic problem facing those who wish to resolve conflicts, a lack of empathy for others who are not exactly like us. It is an interesting exercise that requires us to challenge our most ingrained prejudices, just as we challenge others to confront theirs. A Jewish gentleman told me a joke that you may well have heard before, but I had not. It seemed to fit perfectly with my own situation and perhaps with yours. It's about a CNN reporter who went to the Western Wall to do a story on a very old man who'd been going there every day, twice a day, to pray. She finds the man and she watches him pray for 30 to 40 minutes. As he turns to leave, she approaches him and she says, "Sir, how long have you been coming here to pray?" The man says, "Almost 40 years, twice a day, every day." "That's amazing," says the CNN reporter. "And what do you pray for?" The man says, "I pray for peace between Christians and Jews and Muslims. I pray for all hatred to stop. I pray for our children to grow up with understanding." "I see," says the CNN reporter. "And how do you feel, given all the strife and the attacks and the bombings?" "Well, I've got to admit," says the old man, "sometimes I feel like I'm talking to a wall." I think everyone here can relate to that. Faced with disinterest, disdain, and even outright hostility to the idea of embracing those who we are taught or conditioned to dislike or not care about, sometimes it's hard not to feel that we aren't banging our heads against a wall. But if enough people bang their heads against a wall, one day perhaps that wall will fall. This conference is exceptional because at most conferences, animal issues are not often put on the table. Animals themselves are usually on the table as the main course. Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who treated all beings who were ill and in need of equal care throughout his life, would not have understood that exclusion. When Dr. Schweitzer was a little boy, his mother made him say his prayers every night. He was taught to ask God for mercy for all human beings in the world. But when his mother left the room, Dr. Schweitzer would get out of his bed again and kneel down and add, "Dear God, please protect and bless all living creatures. Keep them all from evil and let them all sleep in peace. Amen." We see human compassion for caring and for callousness every day, but is there a greater context? Some years ago, there was a documentary film called The Animals Film. It showed how animals are used in warfare, starting with animals staked to the ground and put in cages on the decks of ships during the very first nuclear tests on Easter Island and Bikini Atoll. It showed monkeys imported into the U.S. and irradiated, fastened onto treadmills and forced to run until they died in their own vomit. It showed donkeys used to carry bombs and dogs used to test poisonous gases and left to die in convulsions. It also was about how animals are treated as inanimate objects these days, raised on factory farms, where their beaks and their tails and their horns are cut out of their heads without as much as a painkiller. And it was about how whole families of elephants and parrots and other animals are slaughtered in Africa and South America so that their babies can be exported and kept their whole lives in chains and cages as nothing more than living toys or ornaments. And of course, all that still goes on. The advertisement for this film said, "The Animals Film. It's not about them, it's about us." Of course, it really was about them. They were the ones being treated badly and killed painfully. But the film was certainly about us, how we behave. It was about what we are thinking, or how thoughtless we can be, when we do violent things to others who we happen not to relate to, or who, in many cases, we simply dismiss as too unimportant to consider at all. Growing up in India, my mother's house was always full of human refugees, poor and disabled people, unwed mothers who had been cast out by their families, as well as orphaned animals. She always says, "It doesn't matter who needs help, it only matters that they do need help." I didn't realize at the time how wonderful and how uncommon that sentiment is. But I was reminded of her words when I heard this poem by W.S. Merwin called Good People. It reads, "From the kindness of my parents, I suppose it was, that I held that belief about suffering, imagining that if only it would come to the attention of any person with normal feelings, certainly anyone literate who might have gone to college, they would comprehend pain when it went on before them and would do something about it. Whenever they saw it happen in the time of pain, the present, they would try to stop the bleeding, for example, with their hands. But it escapes their attention. Or there may be reasons for it, the victims under the blankets, the meat counters, the maimed children, the animals staring from the end of the world." The question is, why don't enough good people care? It's not as if reaching out to one group takes away from reaching out to another. The problem lies in the definition of me, of my people, and most of all, the definition of others. If we change those definitions, our work is done. Resistance is taught, and it is instinctual. It's not intellectual. To rid ourselves of our biases takes effort, and sometimes it takes an experience. The environmentalist Loren Isley wrote a book in which he recounts a story of when he was living in a cabin in a desolate wilderness place. He trapped two sparrow hawks, a male and a female, to ship to a zoo in a faraway city. But the trapping was at night, and he slipped in the dark as he was moving the birds into a box. The male bird attacked Isley's thumb with his strong beak, injuring it badly, which allowed the hawk's mate to slip out of the box and fly off. When the light came up, Isley examined the male and found he was young and in good condition. The hawk glared at him with fierce eyes as Isley placed him in a small box and thought to himself that by tomorrow the bird would just be an episode. He would leave on the truck to live in a small cage in a city where he would spend the rest of his life. And a good thing, too, Isley thought, because he was sucking his aching thumb and spitting out blood. The next morning, Isley took the box in which the little hawk was imprisoned out onto the grass and started building a cage. As he worked in the sunshine, he thought to himself how fine a day it was to be alive. Then secretively he looked around the camp, and he opened the box. He says, "I got the hawk out in my hand with his wings folded, and I was careful not to startle him. He didn't resist, and he lay limp in my grasp. I could feel his heart pound under his feathers, but he only looked beyond me and up. I saw him look that last look away, beyond me into a sky so full of light that I couldn't follow his gaze. I suppose then I must have realized what I was going to do. I just put the hawk on the grass. For a long minute, he simply lay with his breast pressed against the grass, and then he was gone like a flicker of light." Isley recalls, "He flew up into the towering emptiness of light and crystal that was so intense that my eyes could scarcely bear to penetrate it. There was silence. Then from far up somewhere, a cry. When I heard that cry, my heart turned over. It was not the cry of the hawk I had captured, for by shifting my position against the sun, I could see, coming straight out of the sun's eyes, where she must have been soaring restlessly above us for untold hours, hurtled his mate. And from far up, ringing from peak to peak, came a cry of such unutterable and ecstatic joy that it sounds down across the years as I write. They met in a great soaring gyre that turned into a whirling circle and a dance of wings. Once more, just once, their two voices joined in a harsh, wild medley of question and response echoing across the valley. Then they were gone forever, somewhere into those upper regions beyond the eyes of men. They were others who wished to be free as we do." Practicing nonviolence and nonviolent resistance in the face of violence directed towards us requires great strength. Yet it is an incredibly simple and easy task to act compassionately, as Isley decided to do in the end, and to be consciously nonviolent to those who present no threat to us whatsoever, which is the case with the passive animals we eat, for example. So why isn't this done as a matter of course? Again, it's a failure to recognize the us in the them. In Washington recently, I saw a bumper sticker on a car. It read, "I am you, only different." The car sped off before I could see if the driver was male or female, black or white, young or old. But maybe that was the point. The driver's identity wasn't important. It was the message. I am you, only different. Animals are you, too, only different. On Jewish Voice for Peace's website, there is this criticism. "Aren't you Jews supporting terrorists who attack and kill your own people?" And it's answered this way. "Quite the opposite. We call all attacks what they are. War crimes." What a wonderful thing to get away from the obsession with the identity of the victims and perpetrators of violence and concentrate on stopping the violence itself. In Ecclesiastes, we are told, "For that which befalls the son of man befalls beasts. Even one thing befalls them. As the one dies, so dies the other. Yea, they all have one breath, so that man has no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity, all go to one place, all are of the dust. The Hebrew term for a living soul, nefesh chaya, is applied in Genesis to animals as well as to people. And in Exodus 23:5, we are told, if you see a donkey of your enemy lying under its burden, would you refrain from unloading it? You shall surely unload it with him, which shows the potential of compassion to transcend and even resolve human conflicts. Temptations to separatism are ever present. When Martin Luther King, the icon of the U.S. civil rights movement, protested the Vietnam War, black clergy said he should stay out of it. It was a different issue. It wasn't violence specifically directed at black people. And Martin Luther King said these magnificent words, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." A movement is successful when it's diverse and it recognizes the larger context within which it lies. Violence affects all walks of life, human and animal, and to allow one form of violence to exist while asking for the eradication of the other seems painfully hypocritical. In the days of slavery, not so many decades ago, people in the United States honestly believed that African men did not feel pain as white men do, that African women did not experience maternal love as white women do. And so it was quite acceptable to brand men's faces with a hot iron and to auction off slaves' children and send them vast distances away from their mothers. All evidence was to the contrary, of course, yet highly educated people defied their own eyes and ears and common sense and their own ability to deduce by denying the facts before them, simply because society accepted the exploitation of these races, and it takes a commitment to break away from the norm, even when the norm is ugly and wrong. In Boston, only a few decades ago, a newspaper editorial appeared in which the editor stated that women would never be admitted to Harvard or any other medical school because they would faint at the sight of blood. Women are now inarguably among the finest surgeons we have, yet one might ask, how can women demand an end to male chauvinism when they are human chauvinists themselves? How can one people ask for recognition that their culture and their language and their independence is vital when they don't recognize these things for others who they in turn look down upon and who they can clearly see value these things too? Values must be universal. Principles must apply. Today, we have abolished human slavery, at least in theory. At least we know it's wrong. But we continue to enslave all the other animal species who, if we're honest with ourselves, show us clearly that they experience maternal love as we do, that if you burn them, they scream as we do, that they desire freedom from shackles as we do, and that if you tickle them, they giggle as we do. Examining whether or not our treatment of animals, these odd-looking others, is consistent with our stated nonviolent philosophy is vital to our own personal development as moral agents. If we feel it's asking too much of us to open our hearts and minds to animals' needs and their obvious, inescapable desire to be free of pain, too much to ask that they be treated as if they feel, which they do, then perhaps it's too much for us to ask others to understand those who are alien to them. War is a frightening thing for all living beings. Every day, millions of animals who pledge allegiance to no flag and who have done nothing to provoke aggression are the victims of the longest-running undeclared war in human history, the war on the animal nations. They are killed simply because someone is powerful enough to steal their land, run them out of their homes, take their young from them, cut them up and eat them, experiment on them, use their skins, treat them as amusements to jump and dance and be forced to fight for some human fleeting pleasure. They never can feel secure. They must creep and run. In 1917, 2 years before she was assassinated by the secret police, Rosa Luxemburg, a peace activist jailed for her opposition to World War I, wrote from her cell in the Breslau prison about war and animals. She recounted how soldiers outside her window mercilessly flogged a team of buffaloes who were war trophies from Romania. She wrote, "A lorry came laden with sacks, so overladen indeed that the buffaloes were unable to drag it across the threshold of the gate. The soldier driver belabored the poor beast so savagely with the butt end of his whip that the wardress at the gate, indignant at the sight, asked him, had he no compassion for animals? No more than anyone has compassion for us men, he answered, and redoubled his blows. Eventually, the animals, utterly exhausted, succeed in drawing the load over the obstacle and stand perfectly still. Miss Luxemburg wrote, the one that was bleeding had an expression on his face and in his soft black eyes like that of a weeping child, one who has been severely thrashed and does not know why nor how to escape from the torment of ill-treatment. She thinks of where these buffaloes have come from, the rich green meadows of another land, and how they are now objects of disdain for their nationality, and concludes, I had a visitation of all the splendor of war. Nonviolence can be expressed through kindness to the animal nations, the ultimate kindness being to leave them in peace and refrain from exploiting them, something we do only because we somehow, without thinking, suspend our dearly held belief that might does not make right. A nonviolence movement cannot stand silent while factory farm animals, whose meat is distributed worldwide, are forced to live their entire lives never seeing the sky or breathing fresh air, confined to spaces barely large enough for their bodies, pumped with drugs, beaten daily, fed deliberately nutrition-poor diets, and slaughtered in the most painful and heinous ways. A nonviolence movement can't be complicit by ordering up one of the chickens in Ramallah's main square, Manara, who suffer in cramped cages under the brutal heat, without food, without water. A nonviolence movement can't stand idly by while thirsty and underfed animals are beaten and forced to haul heavy loads, nearly breaking their backs. Mahatma Gandhi, who liberated India from the harsh yoke of the British Empire and is a father of the nonviolence movement, embraced a nonviolent diet and spoke forcefully against frightening animals and stealing their lives for a fleeting taste. The Nobel laureate, Isaac Bashevis Singer, whose family fled Nazi-occupied Europe, became a vegetarian when from the window of his rented room he saw cattle in shackles being beaten down a ramp to their deaths. Many Quakers and Grahams and suffragettes who fought for emancipation of women and the abolition of the slave trade refused meat so as to avoid violence to their own bodies and to animal life. People who try to justify mistreatment of animals by saying that they're stupid and they're dirty are using arguments that have been used historically against those who are marginalized and dismissed. When Sojourner Truth, the black woman campaigner for the abolition of slavery, was jeered at by white men and called stupid, she knew it would be too great a challenge to disabuse these men of their supremacist notion that only they were smart and that she could not be. So she said to them this. She said, What if my little jug does only hold a pint, and yours holds a quart? Wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? In other words, even if we believe ourselves to be superior, we are not entitled to be bullies. When I was 8, I left England to live in Asia. The culture I was used to was completely different from that of the other children I met. So was what I wore, how I appeared, my skin color, my language, and even many of my behaviors. The other children didn't understand me when I tried to communicate with them. They sometimes laughed at my attempts to be understood, and in one remote village, a boy actually came up and poked me with a stick, hard, probably just to see what I was made of. It's true that we don't comprehend the other animals' languages. Doesn't mean they don't have them. It is true that most humans are ignorant of animal cultures. Doesn't mean they don't have them. And that animals' behaviors and needs are quite often misunderstood. So they get poked with a lot of sticks, one way or the other. It isn't right for them any more than it was right for me. Before I describe what we have learned about animals over the last couple of decades that requires that we rethink our attitudes toward them, let me ask you to consider some religious perspectives that, like much in religion, get lost in the hurly-burly of daily life. The Quran preaches kindness to animals, stating that all creatures of Allah are sentient beings, enough to attract our kindness, love, feelings, and compassion. Every kind of cruelty to animals is forbidden in Islam, which outlaws vivisection, the beating of animals, branding them, and baiting animals to fight. The Holy Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, preached compassion and kindness to all living beings. He condemned those who branded animals, confined animals, or tethered them up to practice target shooting, and he stated that it is a great sin for man to imprison those animals who are in his power. He said, "Whoever is kind to the creatures of God is kind to himself," and taught, "A good deed done to a beast is as good as doing good to a human being, while an act of cruelty to a beast is as bad as an act of cruelty to a human being." Why is this forgotten?
Yes, and we've been listening to part of the 60-minute presentation by PETA President, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, President Ingrid Newkirk. It's a wonderful CD called Nonviolence Includes the Animals, and it's available by going to PETA.org, PETA.org, at a very nominal cost. And you've been listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFO Radio, and thank you for listening. And Alex Smith will be over with EcoShock to keep you informed about the environment.
The Garden of Eden is...
little John Reicherman to wind up today's Animal Voices show. And once again, I would like to thank people who supported this year's marathon, our fundraising drive, and remind you that you can still pay your pledge by mailing it into Co-op Radio or giving a phone call here. If you want to talk to us at the program, you can call 684-7561 in the next few minutes. And remember, if you didn't get a membership, you can get one now, 684-7561. I just noticed outside that the next station orientation here at Co-op Radio, if you want to learn about Co-op Radio, you can come down on the third Tuesday of the month, May 20th at 6 o'clock. Just show up here May 20th at 6 o'clock at 360 Columbia Street in the downtown east side, and you can join Co-op Radio, and you can, you don't need to join at that time. You can just get a tour of the station and take part in the station and in this orientation. And one more quick thing. I noticed in the paper the other day that Dick Princep just died. He was a longtime member of Co-op Radio and a long, long time volunteer at Spartacus Books, an activist around town. And I just thought I would salute Dick on the way out. Anyway, coming up right now is the Animal Voices. No, that was the Animal Voices show. Coming up right now is Radio Eco Show.